In this episode of Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks, Popping Pixels, the G-Force is with you. Acer's or something like that, Radeon Pros, and Intel's 9 Lives. Next. Welcome back to another episode of Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks, the show where we try to do our best not to confuse each other or stand out too much one way or the other on subjects, all things tech. And we try and walk the line carefully because we're politically correct around here. Right, Marco?
Only when we're on camera.
I know, I was totally freelancing that one, boy, I tell you. Chris, what's going on up in Maine today?
Well, rainy day, so that kind of sucks, but I've been working on a proposal to revamp our emergency operations center at the police department, so that's always fun, getting some nice big screen TVs to put data up and all that good stuff, so keep it busy.
The war room for saving lives, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Marco, are you saving lives? Are you surviving, actually, down there?
I need someone to save my life. This has been, no exaggeration, probably one of the busiest stretches I've had in recent memory. So, but we're good in the home stretch. Last big launch happening Friday. And then after that, I am going to build myself a new rig. Maybe that'll be next week's podcast. Maybe we'll stream a build, or we'll see. But next week, I am building myself a Threadripper rig. I have to do away with my Ivy Bridge. I don't know if it'll come across during the podcast, but something's dying inside there, and it sounds like I have a cricket in my office.
Is that a cricket in your office, or are you just squeaking under pressure?
Yeah, I think it's either a fan bearing going or a coil on the motherboard. I haven't opened it up, and I'm praying I make it to Friday.
Gotcha. Yeah, we're all going to pray for that, because, yeah, we got a lot of stuff going on, and Marco is absolutely lighting up the homepage at hothardware.com. There's all kinds of tech launches this week happening. We've got one more to go. You know who it's from. I think we can talk about the date, right? It's Intel's got one coming this week.
Yeah, they disclosed it.
They announced. Yes, they did. And so we've been through NVIDIA. We've been through, we're going to be going through Intel. We had a little AMD. I mean, everybody's been jumping into the fray this week. We've got some news coming from Qualcomm. I mean, it's all over the map, fast and furious, and kind of that's the way we like it, but not too fast, not too furious, just moderately so, please. Welcome back. We've got a whole show of tech headlines, reviews, and news to cover, and so we'll dive right in. Lots of stuff going on as we ramp into Q4 here, bring up to the CES timeframe when the world just goes mad down in Vegas for technology. 150,000 plus people converging on that city. But the lead up to that, everybody's teeing up their tech. We've got some initial stuff that just launched now that will be shipping in Q4, and I'm sure we'll hear some new stuff when we get out to Vegas in January too. But let's step through it. Marco spent some quality time with the Google Pixel 3 and the Pixel 3 XL review, killer camera, Android refined, and there they are, the notched wonder and the notchless wonder from Google. We don't want to lean too heavily in the notch because I think we've beat that subject to death. But one of the things that's nice about Pixel phones by Google is that they really do. We say Android refined, and I think that sort of typifies what Pixel launches. And, you know, before that, the Nexus series has, at least Google has intended to typify with the platform. Here is, you know, the best of Android, the way Google envisions it. Marco, were you impressed with Google's vision here with the Pixel 3 series?
You know, yes and no. This is a really interesting one. And I think if you've read some of the articles around the web, opinions are mixed, and for good reason. But this was funny. I came into this review a little bit, I'm not going to say disappointed. I questioned some decisions, but by the time I finished, I changed my mind. So yeah, Let me just quickly recap. These are the two phones. I'm pulling something up on the XL because I want you guys to hear the speakers in a minute. But here is the Pixel 3 XL. Let me turn on the screen so you can see that huge 8-millimeter notch right there. And this 8-millimeter, I measured it. I actually whipped out a ruler. And that is the smaller Pixel 3, the little guy.
Excuse me while I whip this out.
Yeah, so if you're not a huge screen guy, the Pixel 3 really hits a nice balance. This is basically the same specs except for obviously battery size and screen res, but this is much more pocketable and svelte, nice little phone here. Now, I'm going to run down the specs, and some of you are going to go, well, what's the big deal, right? So Snapdragon 845, just like most other flagships out there today, only 4 gigs of RAM, 64 or 128 gigs of storage with no local expandable option. Obviously, you have plenty of cloud storage options. Full HD screen on the Pixel 3, 5.5-inch full HD, 6.3-inch QHD+. They are both OLEDs on the Pixel 3 and Pixel 3 XL. And then everything else that you'd expect. Well, almost everything else. No headphone jack. USB-C port on these guys. Glass front and back with a nice aluminum ring. Really nice build quality. But in terms of specs, they really don't stand out versus the flagship phones that are available today. So when I first got the phones, I'm like, huh, at this price versus something with the same specs or better specs, something like the OnePlus 6, for example, costs a couple hundred bucks less, higher res screen, expandable memory, more RAM. You know, there's cheaper options that seemingly have better specs. But when you use these phones and you test everything out, you know, as they're intended and you actually experience what the phone has to offer, you know, it had really competitive battery life. Performance was the best in a couple of important tests. Like memory performance was the best. PC Mark, that actually runs through a bunch of different workloads, it was the strongest performer of the bunch. Graphics tests are right up there with everybody else. But you have the latest Android and a clean, like unadulterated version of Android, pure Android 9 Pie with Google Assistant. You have, in my opinion, probably the best smartphone camera. The screens are really high quality, not the best, but they're really up there. And the price is lower than some other companies' super flagships. So you don't have like a $1,200 option. They start at $799 and $899. So yeah, they're not killer, you know, across the board in terms of specs, but usability and the experience is really good. And the photos are some of the best, if not the best. I think some people are going to say they're the best. But yeah, I mean, all around, I like the Pixel 3. Some people, I think, are being a little overly negative and overly critical over some stuff that's not a huge deal. But yeah, you know, I'd be interested to hear what you guys think.
You know, one thing that I've liked about Pixel phones and, you know, prior releases from Google is that they are very well refined for the OS. There's a whole lot of careful integration that goes into it, much like, frankly, Apple does with iOS, and things just seem to work properly and cleanly, and nothing's ever janky. And, you know, when you get some of these third-party OEMs in the Android ecosystem, obviously the skins are a little heavier in certain cases in manufacturers. But Google seems to, you know, with the latest version of the OS, in this case Android 9 Pie, they seem to pull off what, you know, really sort of, again, just underscores sort of best practice, I think, with the phone. And I think that's what maybe you're picking up on. There's nothing hugely standout about it, but it just works really well. It's clean. It's just unadulterated, you know, pure, you know, Android goodness, and nothing really gets in the way. You know, you'd think there'd be a standout feature there. There really isn't. How were the displays in terms of, I mean, I know you've got a Galaxy Note 9 there. The last generation Pixel, frankly, I didn't think the OLED display was all that great. Does this come closer to matching Samsung's OLED displays?
So I don't have a Note 9. I have a Note 8 up here. And it comes close. Right. It's a darn good screen, except for the notch on the XL. The notch, it's an 8-millimeter notch, And it doesn't behave like some phones where you can just hide it. It does, you know, hide itself in some apps. But like if you get too many notifications, you just end up getting a dot that basically tells you too many notifications to fit in this spot. You know, so like weird stuff like that with this notch that some people are definitely not going to like. Now, you say there's no jank, and there really isn't, right? I don't want to close this because I want you to hear the audio. But something that's kind of funky is the all gesture navigation with 9 Pi. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this backwards, but you know, there's not a traditional app tray. If you want to get to your apps, first you swipe up once, and then you'll get like shortcuts to your most recently used apps or most likely to use apps. And then you got to swipe up again to get to your app tray. So sometimes it's a little funky. You end up closing an app or switching an app because when you swipe up the first time, you get the app switcher right there that first time. So it's not perfect. Lots of people did not like the fact that Google went with the gesture navigation with 9 Pi. But like, I got used to it in like 2 days, like 2-3 days. I'm like, okay, I can get around. It's fine. It took some getting used to. I wouldn't be surprised if they made some tweaks and changes along the way. It is different coming from a Samsung phone to this. But different doesn't always mean bad, and I think most people took that learning curve as being bad. Now, one other thing I didn't mention earlier was dual front-firing speakers on here that are surprisingly good. Let me see if I can bring something up, because even though we're on camera, it's probably going to come across. Listen to this thing. Ooh. Right? Oh, was I blowing out the mic? I'm sorry.
That's all right. That's all right. It's loud.
Tell me when to stop. Okay?
Right about there, right there.
Like, literally, you could fill the room with the sound out of this thing.
Yeah.
So, and that was Captain Marvel, so we're probably going to get flagged for copyright, but whatever.
Yeah. It was fair use. It was only a couple of seconds there. You're good. You're good. Yeah, you know, they make good phones. How does it feel in terms of industrial design and, you know, fit and finish and all that good stuff? Feel pretty good?
Yeah, in my opinion, it feels good. So I have the XL in one of Google's cases. The regular 3 is not. Now, some people were really complaining about how oily they get. I got to tell you, I'm not putting down Italians because I'm a proud Italian, but I am an oily guy, and you can see this doesn't look horrible. I've been playing with it for days. I'll bring it back over here.
Yeah, they were smart.
That soft touch finish does gather fingerprints. It doesn't look great if you don't put it in a case, but if you put it in a case, you're not really going to notice. In terms of like tolerances and button quality, everything's super tight. It's really nice. You have obviously now you have IP68 water resistance, water and dust resistance too. So yeah, in terms of quality, it's there. They just omitted some features that other flagships have. But I think for a large majority of consumers, having that killer audio, killer camera, clean, fast, you know, version of Android might make up for those shortcomings. Yeah. We'll see. You know, tech press is kind of split on it.
I will say it is one of the best phones on the market in terms of, you know, pull it out of your pocket in auto mode, bang, get a super tight, beautiful shot without trying. And in portrait mode, one of the best portrait modes on the market too, as well with one camera. So they keep costs down there and do it with AI and post-processing and all that good stuff. Yep. And so, there's no question about it. The cameras are strong on that phone. Yeah, you know, it's an interesting offering for sure. Chris, would you go the way of the Pixel, or are you still strictly a Motorola guy? I know you like those Moto phones.
Well, I like Motos a lot because they stick very close to pure Android. So I have, you know, no issues there with the Pixel, obviously. It checks a lot of boxes that I like because it's clean and simple. It just works. The camera is fantastic, which I don't get on Moto. You know, my only real qualm with it, which is my qualm with pretty much every phone out there, is going to be battery life, just because I abuse battery life like very few do. So, you know, I still like with the Moto being able to pop on the battery pack and just go. So that's very nice. As far as the one button navigation goes, I know it's a little different implementation, but I've used it since they introduced it on actually the Moto Z2s. Where it was part of the fingerprint reader gesture navigation. I I find I like it a lot more than the traditional buttons. My thumb just has to know one place to go and then a quick little gesture and I do what I need. Also, I find it does prevent a lot of accidental presses. If you, you know, your palm's just kind of sitting there and maybe hitting the back or the recess button, doesn't happen when you have just the one button in the middle. So obviously it does suck for discoverability reasons, accessibility. You know, if someone has issues with gestures, they're going to have issues using the phone. So that is unfortunate. It'd be nice to see it maybe not the default option like Motorola does with the traditional buttons or as they have done, but leave it as an option you can enable. But everyone's going to choose their own way, I guess, anyways.
Yeah. Good stuff from the folks at Google. I tell you what, though, I'm going to make one little plug here before we move on to the next segment. And that is, if you are considering an Android phone and you want value, this guy right here that is my daily driver is, I think, the unsung hero of 2018 easily. And that is the OnePlus 6. I've got it in notch mode right now. There is a small notch. You can put it in notchless mode and it stays hidden with a thin bezel up top. But this is, in my opinion, the most balanced, well-equipped phone for the money on the market. And so a Snapdragon 845, 8 gig of RAM, 128 gigs of storage for just $579, 6.28-inch OLED display. And last week, I got Android 9 Pi. Came right down over the air. Bang, I've got the latest Android drop on it too. And, you know, really just I forget what they call this. I think it's midnight black. This is a satin black finish on the back. Absolutely. I don't want to say completely fingerprint free, but you really got to work hard to mar this up, even if you are greasy like me and you, Marco. and it just really does a great job of resisting fingerprints. You know, dual rear cameras. I can't say enough about it. Just thoroughly impressed. Headphone jack and USB-C. The OnePlus 6T is coming next. That looks like a great looking device as well. But they're eliminating the headphone jack. I don't know why. I need my Bose IE2s, analog, bang. Sorry, but yeah, great phone for well under $600, $529 if you want the 6 gig of RAM, 64 gig setup, you know? So, I mean, they give you a little extra RAM. They give you good storage for, you know, well under $600 unlocked.
Yep.
Can't beat it.
But they don't support Verizon, and that's what I'm stuck with up here. So
I know. Yeah, I hear you. I have AT&T down here, but yeah, you're right. That's surprising. That must be a radio thing. I'm trying to figure out. There must be a licensing issue there.
Different networks.
Yeah, stupid stuff, stupid carrier crap. All right, well, let's move on from the land of smartphones and talk laptops and start. We've got two Acers on deck right now, but let's start with the thin and light and well-equipped, interestingly equipped, something we haven't really tested in a mainstream laptop yet, the Acer Swift 3 laptop review, affordable and accelerated with Optane, as in Intel Optane. Chris, what do you know about this? Like young fella.
Yeah. So I didn't write this review. It was the other Chris again, but I did write the review for the Acer Swift 3 when the 8th gen chips launched. So I still have one of those here. And I do like the Swift 3 a lot, especially at its price point around, you know, $700 to $800. They're fantastic laptops. No real complaints there, good build quality, all that. So the difference between this one I have here and the one as reviewed by Chris here is that Optane memory inside and the drive. So because the unit I have here has a solid state drive, so it's just going to give blisteringly fast drive access all the time. The new one here with Optane is actually configured with a 1 terabyte spinning mechanical hard drive. So you do get the advantage of having a lot more storage on the device. You know, you get the full terabyte versus the 256 gigs I have here at a lower price. And then it's paired with 16 gigs of Optane. So you still get that faster load time in not everything, but most things you do, especially smaller file transfers that can be accelerated by the Optane memory. That's going to make up for the performance issues you typically see with a hard drive quite a bit. That's not to say you're going to get the exact same performance as the SSD. Looking through some of our benchmarks, this configuration with the hard drive and Optane does trail the true SSD model by a little bit in most tests, not all. So you are going to see some difference, but it's also a lower price. So, you know, if you need the storage and, you know, you're not transferring large file after large file after large file, not a bad option. So a lot to like about it.
Yeah, the nice thing about Optane is for the average mainstream user, right, it's great at random access, small random access patterns, which, you know, when you're firing open applications, web browsers, you know, bopping through the OS, bopping, tripping, whatever. getting a little weird. Yeah, that responsiveness, that initial responsiveness that you look for, that's what Optane helps with. What it doesn't help with are, you know, sort of bigger, heavier duty workloads, whether you're crunching video, whether you're transferring a large file, like you said, accessing, you know, sequential large transfers. But I wonder for the average, you know, mainstream user, when are you gonna feel it? I want to say Chris, that, you know, the other Chris that reviewed it, Chris Ledekin, he noticed it when he was installing. So basically writes, intensive writes, sustained writes, sequential or otherwise, felt pokey. That's when the hard drive felt like a hard drive, but otherwise it felt like an SSD, you know, responsiveness wise.
Right. And most users aren't going to be installing new programs all the time or, you know, even working with a lot of big files. So if you're a more casual laptop user, it's fantastic. Now, you do want to keep in mind that hard drives are still more susceptible to shock. So you could, you know, it's not going to survive a drop as well, potentially, if you get a head crash or something. But if you're not abusive to your laptop, then again, it shouldn't be much of an issue.
Yeah, well, the flip side of that is, I think this SKU retails for $699. So you've got an Ultrabook spec, quad core, eighth gen, I think it was 8 gig of RAM, terabyte hard drive, and Optane, $699. This is totally mainstream. Cheap. Yeah, Best Buy kind of, you know, off the shelf pricing for some pretty good technology on board. Yeah, the Acer Swift 3. And you like the design? Is it all machined aluminum, Chris? You've got one there, right?
Yeah, so it's this one's got the brushed aluminum on it. It's, again, you know, it's solid, it's durable, there's not flex. The hinge is rugged. There's not a lot of give or play, but it moves easily still. It's not quite a one-finger hinge like we see with some of the ultra premium notebooks, but it's not a problem. Nice large trackpad. So nothing to worry about there. I mean, no real complaints. It's, again, for its price class, it's still punching well above what it costs.
Yeah, Marco, you've played with some Optane, and just looking at the sequential transfers in Atto, approaching a gig on reads, and then on writes, it's like a hard drive. You've got like 150, 160 megs hard drive access speeds on writes. Do you think most folks would be happy with that kind of file system response?
So that doesn't really paint the picture completely accurately. We actually have some comments from Shannon in the chat that sort of explain it too. But one thing with Optane, it will basically cache all of Windows, like all of the commonly accessed Windows files will get cached on the Optane. And then once it caches your most frequently used bits of data, it doesn't do like full files, you'll find that during everyday use, it feels like a really fast SSD almost all the time. It's when you're writing new data that you're going to notice that hard drive. But I think most people don't write as much as they think. You know, like, yeah, when you're browsing the web, you have some of those small file writes. But those times when it's going to behave solely like a hard drive are not very common. So once you have everything set up and installed the way you like it, I think Optane is pretty strong in that you get that single volume of, you know, say it's 1 terabyte in this particular machine. You get one big volume. You don't have to manage two drives, but it behaves like an SSD, but at a price only slightly higher than the hard drive. So it's a trade-off. It's not 100% solid state all the time, but I think people that opt for something like this will be happy. Optane memory works as advertised, and those Optane drives are super strong with those small 4K transfers, which are, you know, really important for day-to-day use on a PC.
Yeah, Chris makes an interesting point about the hard drive. The nice thing about, I mean, honestly, solid state frankly feels like the right technology for notebooks, for laptops, where you've got a portable situation here. You're going to be moving that thing around, spinning mechanical hard drive, you know, with shock and vibe, even with, you know, head parking technologies and on the fly, you know, some of the technologies that are built into mobile hard drives. You know, longevity, just it's not going to match an SSD. That said, do we really have to worry when the average life of a laptop is probably less than 5 years at a minimum, right? Being conservative, I don't know.
Yeah, I'd say maybe 3 years.
Yeah. So, yeah, you could save a few hundred bucks. I think it's the kind of machine that, you know, if you're not a big gamer, it's great for business, for casual use, you know, sitting around on the couch, or for the college kid that, again, not interested in gaming, but just want to get some work done, browse the web, watch some Netflix. Perfect for that kind of stuff. The Acer Swift 3, affordable and accelerated with Optane. Well, let's move on, and we actually have another Acer product, and then we'll get to some serious firepower and graphics cards with Marco. But let's talk about the Acer Predator Helios 300. We did a review there. Paul P. Diddy Lily. Oh, there's a bark. Is that Freckles barking?
Yeah, she's playing guard dog. Yeah, I'll go ahead and mute.
No, you don't have to mute. That's great stuff. We like background dog noises. That's just fine. Yes, we're homegrown here. But yeah, so the Acer Predator Helios 300 review. Paul Lilly, who joins us here on Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks once in a while, we got to get him back here. We miss you, Paul. Took a look at this beast, and it's actually much more of a, shall we say, full-figured gaming laptop. It is a 5.5 pound machine, and it is equipped with an Intel six core now, eighth generation, Core i7-8750 processor, 9 mega cache, up to 4.1 gigahertz turbo boost there. 15.6-inch full HD 1080p IPS display, 144-hertz display. Integrated HD 630 graphics from Intel, but also on board, of course, NVIDIA GeForce GTX 1060, a full-fledged 1060, not a Max Q. 6 gigabyte GDDR5 on that, 16 gig of RAM, 256 gig Intel SSD with PCI Express NVMe SSD. Really just loaded for bear. Intel wireless NIC, as well as there's some killer networking going on here. I thought as well. But yeah, just really, you know, decked out heavy duty gaming laptop, and still gets in well under 6 pounds. With a only a 3200 milliamp hour battery. I have to look at what that is for watt hours, but yeah, it's a nice looking machine. Angular, sort of flat black in areas, some red trimmed accents. Certainly the AS and WD keys are accented for gamers. That's what this machine is for, the Predator Helios. And I would say, you know, looking at it, certainly it's a gamer design laptop. One of the more recent near competitors would be Dell's G715 series. A little bit lighter machine there. A little bit lighter config as well. They tend to go more Max-Q GPUs. And when you look at the benchmarks, this machine, the Acer machine, actually puts up better numbers. You know, obviously, you're getting more weight. It's a little bit bulkier. It's a little bit you know, geared towards heavier duty gaming with a little bit higher end GPU. So it puts up some better numbers, obviously. The Dell G715 dropping in just below it with a 1060 Max Q GPU. but you know, really just an impressive machine for the price. $1,299, I believe, MSRP as configured and tested, you know, and that's 16 gig of RAM, that 256 gig NVMe PCI Express SSD and the 1060 all on board with 144 hertz display. So you can't argue with the loadout here for the money. It's actually really, really well equipped. When it comes to the benchmarks, this, the nice thing is it's a 1080p panel. Obviously, if high resolution gaming is your thing and you want to go 4K, you know, that's not here. A lot of folks aren't doing that. Certainly on a 15-inch laptop, that's not generally the use case these days. But what this will do is actually push that 144 hertz display. So you've got games like Middle Earth Shadow of Mordor and Rise of the Tomb Raider, DX12 now. This thing's pushing 124 frames per second. When you get up to 1080, it's in the 100 to 90 frames per second range. Really just actually pushing that monitor and getting that, you know, high refresh rate out of the monitor for buttery smooth gaming. When you talk about getting in the 90 to 100 frames per second across a DX12, you know, AAA title, that's good stuff in a notebook. Are you going to have decent battery life with this thing? Heck no. It's just not what it's about. You've got, you know, our loopback test, our 1080p video loopback test, 183 minutes, you know, 3 hours. It's not bad. It's not going to kill you. You can watch a full length movie, you know, feature movie on that, untethered. When you kick it into gear gaming, you're going to get much less than that. And our battery eater pro test, was 80 minutes. So an hour and 20 minutes or so. You know, you get what you get. If you want that firepower, you're gonna expect to stay tethered to the wall. But Acer puts together again another good value in the gaming segment with this machine, the Predator Helios 300. I'd have to look at what Dell's G715 priced at with the Max Q, because that's, you know, it, sort of what I look at for the spiritual competitor here, I guess, for lack of better words. But you know, I don't think from a cost standpoint it beats it. This thing's decked out pretty well. What do you guys think about that machine?
As far as gaming notebooks go, another really well balanced machine from Acer. That's sort of kind of where what Acer does. You know, you might not get the top of the line premium at about every aspect of the machine, but you get a nice balance and good value for the money. I think that machine in particular, having that 144 hertz display with a powerful enough GPU to actually leverage it, I think it's pretty nice. It's a nice machine. Too big for me to carry around. You know me, I like the little machines, but I think it's decent. And a quick shout out to Marco in the chat. He said, "Evening, people." I like that first name, brother.
Marco Anandan. Okay, Marco Anandan. I was going to say, I wonder if he was an Italian fellow like us, but I can't tell. Maybe he'll tell us. But yeah, actually, going back to the G715 real quick as a comparison machine, interestingly enough, $1,100 for the G715 from Dell. A little bit thinner sort of profile. It's smoothed out. It's a little bit more angular. It's thinner looking machine, but it's actually not lighter. It's 5.8 pounds, where the Acer Predator is 5.5 pounds. You do get 1060 Max Q again, so a little bit lower end skew from a standpoint of, you know, they thermally limit that GPU a little bit to fit into that thinner profile, so, you know, it's throttled back a touch. It's not full fat 1060, but you get a 128 gig solid state drive and a 1 terabyte hard drive. So you've got the 128 gigs for your boot OS, hard drive for your games. Interesting config there. But for $1,199, $1,100, so $100 less, you know, but again, if you want all that firepower, the Acer's notably faster if you step through our benchmarks in the review. Chris, is this your kind of gig, or are you not a gaming laptop guy? Paul loves these things. He's all about the big gaming, powerful gaming laptops.
Well, I'm definitely in Marco's camp where I want the small ultrabook to carry with me and get work done. But, you know, if I had the time to game more and wanted to bring my games with me, then yeah, this would be something that I think I could get used to the size of it for that purpose. I think it'd be great for, again, you know, your college students or, you know, your working professional who also wants to game on the side, and is traveling places, put up in a hotel room, something all fantastic. I also want to say, yeah, it's perfectly balanced. It looks like they took that 1080p screen with the 144 Hertz and then built the system around that, which is how it should be done. You want to know what your end result's going to be. And, you know, you don't want to throw a, you know, 1080 Ti at a 1080p screen, even if, you know, unless you're pushing like 240 Hertz, but then.
Yeah. That's just crazy. Silly at that point. Yeah.
So, you know, it again, well done, Acer.
Yeah. Acer surprises you. They're sort of a sleeper in the market. You know, they're a brand that's recognizable from folks that are in the computing industry or that are enthusiasts, I guess, for sure. Like an Asus, you know, but they've got a wealth of product, especially when it comes to notebooks. And, you know, we probably don't do enough with them, but we just so happened to get two in a row, one in the Ultrabook side and one in the gaming notebook side. In this week, we had them in the queue, and we'd been a little dry on some Acer products. So we took a dive on two different types of SKUs. So good stuff from the folks at Acer. Let's move on to big iron GPUs now for the desktop, where Marco's heart really rests, where he hangs his hat, where it feels like home. Marco launched the GeForce RTX 2070 series for us this week, flavored by the good folks at EVGA. EVGA GeForce RTX 2070 XC review, Turing's sweet spot. Marco, were you in your sweet spot?
I was. I am really thankful that review went smoothly. I'm going to give everybody some background. Last week, had 2 days in New York City, one with Intel, one with Google. And those were two launches that are happening this week. And while I'm planning my week, I got a note from EVGA says, hey, this is on the way. Launch is Tuesday. I'm like, I got to squeeze in another launch. So it went very smoothly. Thank God. The card worked fantastic. Now, to give some background for people that maybe aren't as deeply following the GPU scene, the RTX 2070, RTX 2080, and GeForce RTX 2080 Ti, although they're the same architecture, three different chips powering those three different cards. So you have the TU106 on the RTX 2070, which is the GPU with three GPCs. And how many total CUDA cores? It was 2,304 CUDA cores. Now, the really high end, it's 4,352 CUDA cores on the 2080 Ti and 2,944 CUDA cores on the 2080. You also have a different number of RT cores, the ray tracing cores, and a different number of tensor cores. Actually, I take that back. There's 8 tensor cores across the board on all of them. But in terms of, there's 8 tensor SMs, but different number of tensor cores. So right. You have 288 tensor cores on the 2070, 368 on the 2080, and 544 on the 2080 Ti. So basically, if you shut off some parts on the bigger chips, you end up with the smaller chips. That's really the only difference. Same architecture, though. Now, in terms of performance and pricing, this is where things get kind of nutty with NVIDIA's current lineup, right? So prices are starting at $499, but if you come through and look at the numbers, performance is on, and if you think with a $500 card, performance should be better than something like a 1080 or a Vega 64. And that's exactly what happens. So it's about 10 to 25% faster than a 1080, depending on the test and the resolution. The cards are really geared for 1440p gaming. And the factory overclocked card from EVGA we got, the particular card was the RTX 2070 XC, which is one of the more tame EVGA cards. It's clocked exactly like an NVIDIA's Founders Edition with a boost clock of 1710 megahertz. In some tests, it'll approach a 1080 Ti. It's typically, you know, a few percentage points behind the 1080 Ti, but significantly ahead of a 1080 or a Vega 64 for maybe 10 to 15% higher price than you can find a 1080 or Vega 64. So, you know, there, if you were looking to buy a card like a 1080 2 weeks ago, or a Vega 64 2 weeks ago, the RTX 2070 is the card to get. If you already have a card like a 1080 or a Vega 64, you're probably looking at this going, this thing performs like, you know, a two-year-old 1080. What's the big deal? You know, and then you have the promise of future tech support with RTX and DLSS. So it's not like this huge, big win all around. I like the 2070. If I was considering a card in the $500 price range, I would spend the extra 10% because it is the card to get, in my opinion, right now in that price category. But, you know, the way the graphics landscape is sort of shaping up right now, it's, you know, NVIDIA is commanding a bit of a premium and it is what it is. You know, what do you guys think?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. I sort of struggle with the notion of NVIDIA commanding a bit of a premium. I think what's interesting about the Turing series in general and the RTX 2070, when you think about it versus comparable cards and its performance envelope, you know, it drops in at somewhere between a 1080 and a 1080 Ti. But it has much more advanced GPU architecture under the hood. There are more billions more transistors underneath that, the hood of that GPU, and they're specific dedicated engines for the most part. You know, when you talk about ray tracing engines and you talk about, you know, what they're doing with tensor cores as well and DLSS and all that good stuff. And I just think, you know, really, you know, if you're considering these cards at all, you have to have the notion in your head that you're betting on the come a little bit. It's just part of the deal. You're an early adopter. You're looking at the landscape and you're saying, I'm an enthusiast. Do I want to place a bet on ray tracing being, you know, a mainstream feature in games and improving my gaming experience as a result of that? A DLSS, you know, smart anti-aliasing via AI on tensor cores. Is that going to be a thing? Is AI in general, in terms of image processing in games, going to be a thing? Because, by the way, you know, sure, we're doing DLSS now. Who knows? You get tensor cores on there. Maybe it's going to be something else that will come out that will be enhanced on those AI geared engines under the hood of Turing. So, you know, if you're an enthusiast and you're an early adopter, you're probably going to bite on this thing. If you're the kind of enthusiast that waits it out for a generation or two, and you tend to try and be, I don't know, maybe that's a frugal approach, a practical approach. And you waited out for a couple of releases, you know, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, maybe things will give you a, you know, maybe the landscape will give you a better direction on which to go. But I don't know. If I was going to drop $500 on a graphics card, I would want the most advanced technology I can get right now. And performance is solid. So I would bite on this thing. I would want the most advanced technology I can get, because whenever you jump in, the day you jump in, it starts getting old, right? It doesn't, you know, technology doesn't stop advancing ever. I don't know. Is that being too optimistic?
It's I think it's a little optimistic, a little bit. I'm with you, right? I would also bet on the card. Knowing what we know about the technology, I think NVIDIA is going to reveal some cool multi-GPU. Well, actually, that's not supported on this card. With the 2080 and 2080 Ti, you have NVLink. So I think there's going to be some cool multi-GPU stuff coming there. With the 2070, I personally think DLSS and ray tracing is going to have decent developer support. But by the time that happens, is there going to be a next gen? Like, that's the real question. So you have one group of people are, if I buy a card today, what can it deliver for me today? And right now there's no games that are leveraging that tech where you can just fire it up and say, here it is. On the other hand, you want to be able to support some of that cool stuff, or you're going to regret the previous gen card you purchased. So that's the debate. I personally would buy the latest card as well. And we have a couple of comments. We have Joe Nexus that says he's thinking that NVIDIA forced partners to release some boards at $499 because the 2080 Ti is so high. I don't think so. Jensen revealed that $499 starting price point at the launch last month, or at their initial announcement last month. So I think it was going to happen regardless. And then we have Francois. Francois, former Intel engineer, says, don't forget all these people developing machine learning at home. They want this newer tech. That's obviously a smaller market than enthusiasts and gamers. But getting that new tech into people's hands is how new killer apps get developed. So, that's something to consider as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, if you're the type that sits it out for a round, yeah, okay, sure. You know, maybe you might get more bang for your buck, especially where, the new generation is out now and prices are going to soften on the previous generation. There's no question about it. They're going to be less sought after. And so you're going to see some prices soften on the 1080 series, 1070, 1080 series. But you know, if you're that early adopter that wants to get in on the latest tech, I think, I just think NVIDIA's, they made a silicon bet here. This isn't a software trick. These engines aren't, I guess just efforts with ISVs and game developers to, improve visuals or to get their special sauce visuals into the stack. This is like, yeah, we want you to, ISVs, game developers, here's some new features, but, and we're going to help you develop them, but we've also put some silicon equity behind it. And so to me, that says that's the courage of their conviction. And when I look at these GPUs, I take stock in that a little bit more, and that's just a philosophical thing for me. They've got silicon engines on board. They made a financial bet on a larger GPU that they are damn sure going to try and get support for in the community, in the developer community, to bring out these features and performance in next generation games. We'll see what happens. But I think we talked about this, and let's go back to the headline, Marco. We called this card Turing's sweet spot. If you think about it, $500, when you talk about a $1,200 graphics card, on the 2080 Ti or, and on down, I mean, that's a serious financial commitment. When you talk about a $500 graphics card, maybe it's $500 to $600 price range, that's less. And is it? Sort of, is this the place where if you're kind of unsure about it, but you'd like to get some next generation tech, is it a good entry point?
I think so. Like, if you look at gamers right now, the sweet spot for most monitors is arguably 1440p, right? The biggest chunk of the market has 1440p. This card kicks ass for 1440p gaming with the promise of those future features. So yeah. I think it's the sweet spot in that regard. Now, the graphics cards that sell the most are like the $200 to $300 range. This is obviously double that, if not more. So it's not the sweet spot of the market, but it's the cheapest cost of entry for the true next-gen Turing. And right. it really is going to offer strong performance for a really huge chunk of the market. And then looking forward, we have another comment from Joe saying, next year, the 7-nanometer 2180 Ti is probably going to be the card to get. But we could say that about every new GPU release. The next one's almost always going to be better. Yeah, of course. But, I think if you want the best of the best today, Turing is it. So
I think that's the difficult thing to understand here. You have hit an inflection point in GPU architecture where there are tangible major new processing engines that have been introduced in silicon now, and they are the first iteration out of the gate. So the flip side of that is, yeah, if you're an early adopter, you know, this is like the most, you know, forward-looking thing you can get these days. And so it's really, you know, maybe the next generation in 7 nanometer will be optimized. Maybe the next iteration of tensor cores will be optimized. You could bet on that, you know, for the next gen a year from now. So yeah, I guess, you know, the flip side of that is, yeah, this is an entirely new architecture and entirely new, in some cases, method of rendering frames. Chris, you sound like you want to jump in. What do you think?
So, I mean, another way to phrase the question is, if you had, say, a theoretical GTX 2070, GTX 2080, whatever, that's the same performance as your RTX 2070, 2080, but without the RTX cores and other new tech, how much cheaper would it need to be for you to be willing to give up that forward-looking technology?
No. That's a deep question.
Well, I mean, I think we can answer. I think we can answer where it would be, because like the 1070 was introduced at $379. You know, so if NVIDIA didn't make that silicon bet and have to pay for that larger, you know, pay for those transistors, that's probably where the card would have launched. You know, it would have replaced the previous gen with the similar naming. You know, that's speculation, and you know, that's simplifying things a lot because NVIDIA kind of moved everything up the stack, but. You know, that's probably where it'd be. So, I mean, you're going to pay for that new tech is what it boils down to. I mean, there's transistors, there's silicon on the board that took many hundreds of thousands of engineering hours to develop. And, you know, that stuff's not free.
So then looking forward at the assumed 2060 that's going to be coming out as probably a GTX without the RTX cores, do you think it's going to come in line with pricing where we saw the 1060, or do you think they're going to bring up the price a little to have less of a leap into the RTX cards? Assuming, of course, so, it doesn't have RTX.
Yeah, assuming that. I think so. If you look at like core counts and clocks, the Turing architecture, disregarding RT cores and tensor cores, just for gaming, it's more efficient and faster clock for clock than Pascal, right? So even without the RT cores and the tensor cores, because they've moved to the newer, again, we're assuming it doesn't have RT cores and tensor cores. There's no confirmation there. With the newer manufacturing process, not only are you looking at more efficient cores, you're probably looking at newer cores and the smaller die if it doesn't have all that other tech. So I think NVIDIA could be far more aggressive with pricing on a proposed 2060 if it happens. Will they do it? I don't think so, because AMD has nothing to scare them right now. So we'll see.
Yeah, that's really what we need, actually, is competition, frankly, like we have with on the CPU front with Intel and AMD there, because yeah, they, you know, do you have to when you're frankly the best game in town? No, you don't. And another notion came to mind, Marco. Let me see what your thoughts are on this, and then we'll close out the segment on RTX 2070. But if I was going to get a new Turing card of any ilk, honestly, and you know, there's a premium here, but I really like the Founders Edition designs. I mean, the EVGA's card is great. If you're just getting one card and you're putting in your system, and you can spare three slots. Three slot design, no problem, right? But the Founders Edition card is just so compact, sleek, and well built that I don't know. What are your thoughts of that versus, and you've seen a lot of them now. You've seen Founders Edition and OEM cards. What are your opinions? What are the merits between the FE cards and what you saw from the folks at EVGA? And they make great stuff too. But
yeah, so the plus side of the Founders Editions are the two slot design. They're really, if you were to pick one up, it's like a 5.5 pound, really well built, premium feeling card, right? You don't get that same feel grabbing a plastic shroud on some of the other cards. However, okay, some of the other cards, you'll end up with lower temps, and some of them are dead silent at idle, or most until they hit a certain temp threshold, the fans don't even spin. So you end up with a quieter experience overall as well. I think it boils down to the design of your system, what you want to show off. I don't know. Like I think those triple slot cards are really massive and huge, but this isn't the enthusiast space of 15 years ago when everybody filled every drive bay and every slot had a card in it. Now yeah. most systems have a couple of drives and a big GPU and that's it. So yeah. I think it's a matter of mm-hmm. preference.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's interesting. I guess I get that. Little voice in the back of my head that says, oh, it's consuming three PCI Express slots. Oh my God, this is so inefficient. But I'm not putting anything in those slots other than a GPU, really, these days. It's just not. Well, PCI Express SSD, maybe, but even that's going away with NVMe and the M2 slots. So, yeah, good points. Good points all around. All right. Let's move on. We'll sort of round out real quickly on something from AMD. They did actually release a new GPU recently, the Radeon Pro WX8200. This is a pro graphics card. Look at that beautiful hue of blue. Powerful, affordable workstation graphics. Marco, you did that too, because you're doing everything on the site these days.
So I'm going to go super fast because I have two kids itching for me to get out of here in the next room. They were just at the door. I'm sorry if you guys heard the little chat. But yeah, the Radeon Pro WX8200, really cool graphics card. So the WX Pro lineup, the previous flagship, well, the current flagship, I should say, is the WX9100. That's a full-fat Vega core with 16 gigs of HBM2, but it debuted at nearly $2,000. So AMD said, we need a more affordable option without sacrificing much in terms of performance. So the Radeon Pro WX8200 is essentially a similar Vega core to a Vega 56, slightly scaled back GPU core with 3584 stream processors on there. And it's only got 8 gigs of HBM2, but it's clocked higher than the WX9100. So you end up with, you know, half a terabyte per second of memory bandwidth, 512 gigabytes a second of memory bandwidth. But the card is just under $1,000, MSRP $999. So, you know, about 80% of the price of the 9100. Now, in terms of performance, it's really strong in GPU compute stuff. It beat a Quadro P4000 in 5 of 9 of the spec view perf tests. And it beats the P5000 in 2 of the tests, but the Quadro P5000 is double the price. And it's only about $150 more than the P4000. So AMD struck a really nice balance here. If you're in the pro graphics crowd, this is definitely a card to check out. In that space, this one really does hit a sweet spot, that sub $1,000 price point, but with performance that's competitive with cards that are much more expensive. I think it really looks good too. This is actually what I'm going to put into my personal rig when I build it next week. I'm going to do an all AMD WX based build with this card and a Threadripper WX. Should be a really nice system. But yeah, if you're a pro graphics guy, you should check out this card.
Interesting. So you're going with the WX card for your graphics card. You are, I would say now, because you know you work a lot with your computer versus game as much as you used to. That's what happens when you're in this thing. You get into it for the enthusiast side, and then all of a sudden, no, you're working a lot. You don't get enough time to play. But so you're okay with that as a content creator, as you know, to go with that pro graphics route and have maybe a little less gaming performance in the back end.
Yeah, so here's my thought process. The games that I've been playing, right now, I'm still on an Ivy Bridge rig with a Fury card, a single Radeon Fury, and I'm not sitting here going, bleh, my gaming performance sucks, right? So this is way faster than than the Fury card. Plus, this is another cool thing with AMD's pro graphics cards. You can switch between the consumer driver and the pro driver. Right. So I want a rock solid workstation. You know, the chipset for Threadripper is over a year old. Motherboards have been out a long time. They're fairly mature. I'm comfortable with a Threadripper workstation chip as my processor because I'm not really giving up anything coming from such an old Intel processor. And it's a major upgrade in terms of graphics. Plus, I'm going to get much better storage, all that other good stuff. So it is across the board an upgrade for me. Is it the fastest rig you can build for gaming? No. but it's going to be plenty fast with all of the benefits of that qualification that go into a workstation class product.
Yeah. Will not break. That's the hope.
I can break anything, but we'll see.
You and me both. You and me both. Well, yeah. You know what? Let's wrap up. We got like 30 seconds left, and let's talk about something that you're working on now. The Intel launches ninth gen core CPUs, 8 core, 16 thread, $488 Core i9, 9900K, shipping in October. Things are getting interesting between Intel and AMD and the CPU wars. What can we expect here? And I know you got to be careful how you tread.
Yes, I got to be careful. So last week, Intel made all these announcements. So we're not like disclosing anything crazy. The ninth gen big Core X chips are still based on Skylake X, but new clocks, new branding. That is not what we're testing, but those are coming. I believe it was later in Q4. I don't remember exactly.
Right.
They announced a really cool unlocked Xeon workstation processor that's coming later as well. That's going to be an absolute monster. But the truly new piece of silicon are these ninth gen, topped out by the Core i9-9900K. These are the 8-core new chips for the mainstream desktops. It's not mainstream in price, but it's, you know, the Socket 1151 platform. And yeah, you know, 8 cores at 5 gigahertz, not all 8 cores at 5 gigahertz, but they do turbo to 5 gigahertz. It's not like the 8086K where it basically never happened. This one does do it. And it's right over there. It's being tested. Cannot show everything, but yeah, we'll have that article goes up the on the 19th, if you want to see what the 9900K can do. Intel has billed it as the fastest gaming processor. We'll see if that's true. There's been some debate over some benchmarks that were released by some paid benchmarks that cause a little bit of a stir, but you don't need to worry about that stuff because I am running my own set of numbers and you'll see them here. I will see them at Hot Hardware. And let's just say this. If you take Intel's latest processor cores and you run them at 5 gigahertz and you pair them on brand new motherboards, it's going to be fast. Yeah. We'll see how everything else shakes out.
Yeah. That's not giving too much away. You're right. It's going to be fast, guaranteed to be fast. And then you have to look at the price performance equation from there. And guaranteed, we will have that all spelled out in the days ahead. So stick around. That's launching Friday, right? Is that fair, right, to say?
Yes. If you want to see independent 9900K benchmarks, Friday morning, 9 a.m. Eastern on Hot Hardware.
It will be, Jonexus says, it will be the fastest consumer CPU, but at a cost. Well, yep, that probably is not far from wrong. Chris, are you okay with shelling out your hard-earned dollars?
Oh, there's always a cost and never enough money to go around. So,
all good. Well, make sure you stick around hothardware.com where Marco's review for the 9900K from Intel, Intel's ninth generation core technology, will be coming in just a matter of 2 days, like 48 hours or less, maybe 36 hours or something like that. Yeah. It's coming on Friday, and it's going to be interesting. So swing on by hothardware.com, where you can find us on the web, youtube.com/hothardware, where you are hopefully going to hit thumbs up and subscribe here. So, and the little reminder bell, ding that thing too, so that it'll tell you when we go live, we go streaming with this thing. And we'd love you to join us and ask your questions, and we'll try and answer them always. And let's see, facebook.com/hothardware, twitter.com, where you can tweet us, /hothardware, @hothardware. Please interact with us. We'd love to meet you and you know, share whatever pearls of wisdom we can. Right, guys? Right, fellas?
Yeah, absolutely.
And with that, we will bid you adieu. Thanks for stopping by.